Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
Black civil rights spokesmen, on the other hand, have had only praise for the Supreme Court's decision. Rape laws, they said, are racist because a disproportionately large number of blacks have been charged under them. Nowadays, gangs of black thugs hang around parking lots and school playgrounds and roam the corridors of office buildings and apartment complexes, looking for any attractive, unescorted white girl, and knowing that punishment, either from the disarmed citizenry or the handcuffed police, is extremely unlikely. Gang rapes in school classrooms have become an especially popular new sport. Some particularly liberal women may find that this situation provides a certain amount of satisfaction for their masochism, a way of atoning for their feelings of racial guilt. But for normal white women, it is a daily nightmare. One of the sickest aspects of the whole thing is that many young whites, instead of opposing this new threat to their race, have apparently decided to join it. White rapists have become more common, and there have even been instances of integrated rape gangs recently. Nor have the girls remained entirely passive. Sexual debauchery of every sort on the part of young white men and women, and even children in their preteens, has reached a level which would have been unimaginable only 2 or 3 years ago. The queers, the fetishists, the mixed-race couples, the sadists, and the exhibitionists, urged on by the mass media, are parading their perversions in public, and the public is joining them. Just last week, when Catherine and I went into the district to pick up the salaries for our unit, which finally came through when we were down nearly to our last can of soup, there was a nasty little incident. While we were waiting at the bus stop for a homeward-bound bus, I decided to run into a drugstore a few feet away to buy a newspaper. I was gone for no more than 20 seconds, but when I came back, a greasy-looking youth, approximately white, but with an afro hairstyle popular among young degenerates, was taunting Catherine with obscenities while dancing and weaving around her like a boxer. Here is inserted one of the editorial notes to the reader. Afro refers to the Negro or African race, which, until its sudden disappearance during the Great Revolution, exerted an increasingly degenerative influence on the culture and lifestyles of the inhabitants of North America. I grabbed him by the shoulder, spun him around, and hit him in the face as hard as I could. As he went down, I had the deep, primitive satisfaction of seeing 4 or 5 of his teeth come washing out of his shattered mouth on a copious flow of dark red blood. I reached into my pocket for my pistol, fully intending to kill him on the spot, but Catherine seized my arm and caution returned. Instead of shooting him, I straddled him and directed 3 kicks at his groin with all my strength. He jerked convulsively and emitted a short, choking scream with the first kick, and then he lay still.
We want to go Las Vegas? Las Vegas. We haven't been there in a while. Las Vegas, you're on the air.
Howard.
Yeah.
You said you watched the OJ hearings yesterday?
Yeah.
Well, I was watching it too. Can you tell me who the hell's on trial there? Furman? I mean, come on. They're dogging the guy out. Seems like he's the one on trial there.
Yeah, it's not the OJ trial anymore. It's the Mark Furman trial. But it's all backfiring in their face anyway. Mark Furman's like a real cool guy, man. He really, you know, kept his composure with all those people trying to make him look like a jerk. And I hope he does sue those lawyers for, defamation of character.
Right.
They have absolutely nothing to go on that this guy's a racist and they're ruining the guy's life. They're just ruining this dude's life.
He's listening to
this. He might as well tattoo a big swastika on his head for the rest of his life now, because wherever he goes, black people are going to think he's a racist.
Yeah, he might as well go join the KKK.
Yeah.
He has no choice.
Yeah, he might as well. It just doesn't make a difference anymore. And Effie Bailey's a blowhard and you know,
yes,
although
exactly.
I don't blame Effie Bailey so much because, quite frankly, there's no case there. They're trying to make stuff up. They don't know what to do. OJ's guilty.
They're listening to people's dreams now and taking testimony.
Yeah, it's weird. But you know what? I still say OJ will get off. Thank you.
I think he will, too.
Right.
Guilty, though. Guilty of sin.
Guilty of sin, that's right.
All right, you can feel better, Howard.
Thanks, dude.
Take care.
It was interesting. I heard one of the commentators say, you know, he could have been making some points to jurors who want to lean that way.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Even though it had no basis in fact.
Yeah, no proof.
You tell
so
him,
what, I don't care if he said the word nigger every day. There's
yeah.
no proof he put a glove somewhere that didn't belong, and he didn't take O.J.'s blood and put it at the scene of the crime or take the blood and put it in his house.
Yeah, that's a little far-fetched.
The Cal's context of white supremacy, Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Wednesday, January 6th, 2021. So I have been told. We have two OJ days this week. We're still doing our book club. Jeffrey Toobin, The Run of His Life. We're picking up tomorrow, Chapter 11 on the Dream Team. He'll give more details about O.J. Simpson's illustrious attorneys who helped to get his acquittal in the 95 criminal trial. Our broadcast for today, there's so many books on the O.J. Simpson trial that one can pretty easily amass a pretty nice-sized library of books that were written like back in 95, mid-90s, when the trial was taking place and or after it concluded, and subsequent books that have talked about the media aspect and jurisprudence and race and domestic violence, all different components of the trial. I've said since we've been doing all of this that I feel really embarrassed. I didn't know a whole lot about Mark Furman. I didn't follow the trial and all that. So it has been a humbling learning experience for me. I will say reading more important than watching television. Wow. You can read a lot about O.J. Simpson and other books to get a better understanding of racism, what it means to be white with this entire case. The audio segments that we started things off with today. So we heard the first segment. Man, we've had a book club on the cows. Our current book club selection, Jeffrey Toobin, Run of His Life. We've had a book club on the cows for nearly a decade. We started our book club way back in 2012, almost a decade. So the first book we read was Dr. Marimba Ani Shirugu. Second book we read, the late, great Toni Morrison, The Bluest Eye. We've read two of her selections on the book club. The third book we read in the history of the cows, Dr. William Pierce, The Turner Diaries. Got to that one so quickly, and it has come up so many times. We talked about the bombing in Oklahoma City and so many other things. So to see that book pop up again, and what were they talking about? Raping white women, greasy Negro youth out raping and terrorizing white women. Rape laws have been trashed. They talk about lots of things in the Turner Diaries, but raping white women is a big problem. Then we transitioned to that and we heard Howard Stern. That was from March 1995, right at the kind of beginning of the O.J. Simpson trial, which didn't conclude until that October. Did you hear what they said? That Mark Furman is an excellent guy. Wow. They're just trying to ruin his reputation. Man, can't believe. Did you hear? They said he might as well get a swastika tattooed on his forehead, the way that they've talked about him and ruined his, that no-count F. Lee Bailey. Oh, what a disgrace. Now, this is about 5 months before the Furman tapes were released, and some of the other witnesses who ended up testifying for the defense, like, wow, what a time capsule. So glad that we're doing the study session. Our guest for today, even, he was the one. It made me think about that, to go back and check out. He writes in his book about Don Imus and some of the talk radio coverage of the trial at the time. We'll see if that's representative of the type of things that we were hearing way back, 1995. Our guest for today's program, he has written a number of books, 25 of them, unless I am in error, nonfiction, many of them about high profile criminal cases like we're going to discuss today. He's also written about sports, business biographies, and social commentary. He co-authored with his wife, Joyce, their two most recent true crime titles, and His first book, I think, is linked to what we're going to talk about today, Talk to Death, The Life and Murder of Alan Berg, which also dealing with racism, white supremacy, made into a big film and everything. The book we're discussing today, Legacy of Deception, dealing with the whole history of racism, white supremacy in the LAPD, and Grohl, Mark Furman. So glad to have him as a guest on the program today. Joining us live, our guest feeling under the weather, but hanging in nonetheless, joining us live, Mr. Stephen Singular. Mr. Singular, are you with us?
Yes, I am. Thanks for having me.
Thank you so much for joining us on the broadcast. Pleasure to kind of go through some questions about this, what do they call it, case of the century, to get some of the details and how you became involved with the case. For our listeners who have not seen you, you are a white man, yes?
Yep.
Right on. And you're joining us, you're joining us from the Colorado area, is that correct?
That's correct, yeah.
Okay. Wow. And before we get begin to get into your book and how you got involved in all of that, I think it's so important. We ask all of our guests who come on the program. I use the term racism and the term white supremacy. I use them as synonyms, and I use the same definition for both terms. The definition I use is as follows: a global system of people who classify themselves as white and are dedicated to abusing and or subjugating everyone in the known universe whom they classify as not white. Do you think such a system exists? Do you think that definition is accurate?
Yeah, no, I think it's pretty accurate. I think that that's definitely a worldwide thing, and yes, I mean, I've been writing about this since 1984, so that's when I started. That's when I really dived into it with the murder of Alan Berg here in Denver in June of 1984. He was gunned down in front of his townhouse on June 18th of that year, and people thought he was a talk show host, and he was quite controversial. And people thought that one deranged or angry listener had probably killed him. The police started out thinking that, and the public did too. As the case unraveled over the next 4 months, it became part of the largest investigation into domestic terrorism in American history. There was a group of white racist supremacists, neo-Nazis, whatever word you want to use, from the Northwest called the Order. And the Order came out of the Turner Diaries. The Turner Diaries, as you said, is this novel by William Pierce, who wrote under another name. And it's a viciously violent, you know, racist piece of writing. And the core group inside of it is called the Order. And they decide to get rid of minorities, gay people, feminists, liberal judges, and just wipe out all of their so-called enemies. And on one day, they kill 60 million people. So it's a very outlandish book, you know, and then in 1983, a man named Bob Matthews came along in the Northwest and said, why don't we put this into reality? Why don't we try to act this out? I mean, that's a really grandiose idea. And so nine men gathered in the Idaho woods in 1983 in the fall and swore their loyalty to one another, the Silent Brotherhood, and decided to start their own white power revolution. In the end, they would commit 240 federal crimes, kill five people, the most prominent being Alan Berg. They came to Denver and sat outside his townhouse, waited for him to come home. There were four men in the car. One of them, that man's name was David Lane, and he lived in Denver for much of his life, and he argued with Berg on the radio. So when they were looking for an initial target, he said, let's go to Denver and take this guy out. So all of these strands that you're talking about, you know, come together sort of right there. The Turner Diaries, the violent racism, anti-Semitism, and, you know, the idea of, you know, basically starting this this revolution and getting rid of, you know, your ethnic enemies as they saw them.
context of white supremacy, folks can go back in the book club archives to check out the Turner Diaries. And I would be remiss with everything that's happening right now, the unruliness in the Capitol and what have you, might have some relevance to what's happening right now. Just maybe. Anywho, you talk about you've been writing for a long time and done all of these true crime nonfiction novels. So we get to 1994, and for listeners too, we'll get a hand up. We'll get questions in as we go. Mr. Singular is not feeling his best, so we won't have him for the full program. We'll try and see if we can cover as much as we can, get as many questions, get a hand up if you have a question as well. But you talk about 1994, the murder of Nicole Brown Simpson and Ronald Lyle Goldman takes place that summer right at the beginning. And how do you get involved? How do you start getting tips that something might be a little different than what the standard news coverage is of these murders?
Well, I had written about neo-Nazis, as I said, in the book that I wrote about Alan Berg, which was called Talk to Death. He was killed in 84. The book came out in 1987, the Oliver Stone movie Talk Radio, is sort of loosely based on that book that came out in 1989. So I had done a lot of investigation of, you know, white racist groups. And to my complete amazement, on August 2nd, 1994, which was about 7 weeks after the crimes in Brentwood of Nicole and Ron, which was June 12th, I received a call from a source that said, you know, there's more to the O.J. Simpson case than meets the eye. And, you know, would you like to get involved? And I was like, well, that's a long shot. You know, I mean, everybody around me seemed to think he was guilty, just like Howard Stern and his sidekick. And that was the drumbeat of the media from the, almost the day this began. And so I kind of resisted at the start. I mean, like, what could I do? I'm sitting in Denver, and this is happening 1,200 miles away in Los Angeles. And he said, I'm going to give you four pieces of information that aren't known really at all. And they will get the defense's attention, and they will have an impact if you can carry out this plan. And I said, well, why don't we give them to the prosecution? I mean, they're the ones that need to know what the evidence is. And they said, they'll never listen to you. They've already made up their minds that OJ's guilty, and they're not going to listen to anything else, which absolutely turned out to be the truth. So I got the call on August 2nd. I made contact with Johnny Cochran's office on August 4th. Johnny Cochran, as most people probably know, was the second in command at that point legally for O.J. Simpson. And his first lieutenant was a man named Carl Douglas. And Carl was this very, very hard-nosed lawyer. And he tried to resist what I was bringing in. But on August 8th, I flew to L.A., met with him and one of his private investigators, and I gave them four pieces of information, and they were basically in this sequence: that Furman had some sort of relationship with Nicole Simpson, not saying they were intimate, not saying they were lovers, but that they had some connection beyond what was generally known. The PI, the private investigator for Douglas, named Bill Pavlik, completely pushed back on that and said, that's not true. I told him there was a broken piece of stick that had been retrieved from OJ's estate that was in evidence. I told him there was a blue plastic police evidence bag that was in evidence. And these were used in the moving of evidence to be used against Simpson. If you were listening to what Howard Stern, and I think that her name is Robin Quivers or something like that, was saying, you know, there's no evidence, there's no proof, none of this happened, it's all a fantasy. I gave the defense those three pieces of information, and then by far the most important piece was that when a criminal suspect is taken into custody, as O.J. was on the afternoon after the murders, their blood is drawn, and it's placed in a vial, a little purple cap vial. And in the bottom of that vial is a compound called EDTA, and it's a preservative. It's an anticoagulant that is there to preserve the blood so it can be tested for DNA or tested against other pieces of evidence standard operating procedure. So when Simpson was taken in, he freely, you know, gave his blood, didn't ask for a lawyer, you know, just tried to cooperate with the police, gave them his blood. And I was told that there were blood, pieces of blood evidence in the case that had been collected that would contain this compound of EDTA, which meant only one thing, that it didn't come out of his body on the night of the crime, but it came out of that vial afterwards. Carl Douglas and the defense basically said, you know, you're wrong, that could never have happened. Have a nice trip back to Denver, et cetera. But before I left, Douglas sort of grabbed my arm and said, get me more information. So he was listening. He was processing. So they went out and they found in the what's called the murder book, the evidence book, all the photographs of evidence, et cetera, a broken piece of stick and a blue plastic bag, which was thrown over the fence from right where the glove that Furman claimed to have found, right across from that. We all know that he found it on that walkway, kind of where Cato Kalin was staying. And so the evidence bag was there. The broken piece of stick was there. I was told that Furman and someone else did not make just one trip over to Rockingham, where O.J. lived that night, at about 5 or 6 in the morning, which is a story everybody knows. But they had gone there earlier at 3 a.m. to look for evidence that they would that would prove that O.J., you know, committed this crime. They went over there. They couldn't find any evidence. An argument took place. A witness named Rosa Lopez, who worked for the people across from Simpson, heard these men arguing in the middle of the night, a heated argument, which I would speculate was, you know, they left the scene of a crime, which was unprofessional. They came over there to find something, and they didn't find it. And now, you know, they would be potentially in trouble for doing something like that. So they went back to the crime scene, utilizing a stick and a bag, a glove. Furman testified in the preliminary hearing, you know, that he saw them on the ground, them in quotations, meaning two gloves. So the next thing that happened is that he talked to other police officers and going back to O.J.'s, Furman puts those other officers inside the house, goes out and looks around, and guess what happens? He finds this glove. The bag was discarded, as I said, on the side of the fence, and the broken piece of stick was discarded near the Bronco. So once the defense found the stick in the bag, they thought, okay, maybe this guy's onto something. Maybe we should listen. And what I was saying all along to them was, get some blood swatches and test them for EDTA. And if it comes back positive, you had, there's your case. I mean, evidence was clearly planted. The guy was clearly framed. In addition to all the other things that don't add up, like the timeline, et cetera, this is hard proof that blood was planted against him in the case. So getting the blood tested was a very difficult thing to do. It sounds rather simple, but I went to L.A. again in October. Cochran and Douglas had asked me to infiltrate the LAPD crime lab and figure out what had happened with the blood. What we had learned in the interim period is that while Douglas was saying this is impossible because once blood is drawn, it's sealed and put into evidence, what actually happened, and they had it on tape, was that Philip Benatter, one of the other of the four main detectives, took that blood on the day it was drawn, put it in his pocket, went back to, I think, both crime scenes, or both the Bundy crime scene and O.J.'s house. They had drawn 8 milliliters of blood, and when the blood vial was turned in, there was 1.5 milliliters was missing, which is enough to create blood drops. So not only did he not check it into evidence, not only did he go back to the crime scene, but blood was missing. Once the defense learned that, they started to listen more and more. So, so now we have three pieces of evidence.
Can I get in two quick questions before you look at these three pieces of evidence, the bag, the stick, and then if you want to call it the missing blood or the question mark, the blood, EDTA,
right.
Where did this come from? What would your response be to folks who want to push back on two points? They say, number one, Mark Furman is not the first officer to arrive on the scene at Bundy to discover the bodies of Nicole Brown Simpson, Ron Goldman. He's not the first officer. There are other officers there, so it would have been totally impossible for him to come in and tamper with evidence when you've got other officers there. Looky-loos, press and such are starting to come in for him to come in, and there are two gloves for him to snatch one and put it in this police baggie and then hide it on his person or in a sock or something. What would your response be to that?
It was the middle of the night. It was dark. I mean, you know, he was the first detective on the scene. He wasn't the first officer, but he was a detective, and it was his case until Van Adder and Lang came along a couple hours later and basically took it away from him. So I say it's the middle of the night. He was the first one to closely inspect the evidence. He testified under oath in the preliminary hearing that he saw them on the ground. That's what he's referring to. You know, so he himself gave away the game, as he did over and over again in his career, you know, by talking about planting evidence or beating minority suspects or, you know, being very racist. So that's what I say. The first trip over there was corroborated, again, by a witness, Rosa Lopez. And when they went back, they damn sure had to have some evidence. And then if you just follow the sequence of events, he gets rid of the other three officers. He plants him inside the house with Arnell Simpson, who's O.J.'s daughter. And then he goes back out on his own. And the next thing you know, he's got this glove. The glove was sticky and wet. And it was one of the things they said in the trial. If a glove was laying on the ground for, what, 8 hours or so, 7-8 hours, it would have begun to dry. But it wasn't. What under what conditions would a glove remain sticky and kind of stuck together? I would suggest it would be inside of a bag, crumpled up. So, to me, if these pieces of evidence had not existed, if I had been leading someone on a wild goose chase, that's one thing. But everything I told them is going to be corroborated as the story goes along.
What's your response with regards to the blood? The people say now that's another one, Mr. Singular. They don't get Mr. Simpson's blood until the next day. And Detective Van Adder, maybe he doesn't check the blood in immediately. And there is some time between when he actually hands it over properly to the criminologist. Maybe that's true. And maybe there might even be some missing blood. But I mean, hey, this is like 16, 18 hours after the murder. How exactly would they get blood from Mr. Simpson on Monday, 13 hours after the murders, and retroactively have it planted on these different crime scenes? How would they do that, Mr. Singular?
Well, what I told the defense was, I'm not telling you this is the truth. I'm telling you test the blood. If I'm wrong, I'm wrong. And I'll probably just go away. If I'm right, that's your case. I mean, you have clear, hard evidence of planted blood. That's called in the law Brady material. That means that's material that exonerates a defendant. So what happened was I went back and forth with the defense for about 3 months. And when I realized I really wasn't getting that far anymore, I wrote a book proposal, which is just what I do based on all this information that wasn't public information at the time at all. And wrote it up, sent it to a publisher, and the next thing I know, I call up Carl Douglas. We had a pretty good relationship after 3 months, and he was just steaming angry, mad at me. And he said, on my desk, I have this proposal. You know, you sold us out. I'll never speak to you again. slammed down the phone, and he never did speak to me again. At the time, which was right around November 1st, 1994, and the significance of that is it's 3 months before the trial is going to start. At the time, it seemed like the worst possible thing because it ended my relationship with the defense, and that was a painful break. But the prosecution also had the proposal, and so did the New York Times and L.A. Times and others in the media. So they knew what was in the wind right then, and they all more or less dismissed it. But it was such an outrageous allegation that the prosecutors felt compelled to discount it, to, as they put it, refute the possibility of any DNA in the blood. So in February, about a month into the trial, they called in the FBI and asked Judge Ito, can the FBI test this blood to, again, refute the possibility, not to find out what's in the blood, not to learn the truth of the matter, not to know what the facts are, Howard Stern, but to kill it. So the judge said, okay. They brought in the FBI. There were three people who tested the blood, and one of the people who didn't test the blood was picked to testify in court, and he said some things that the other three thought were not true, both in terms of saying that he did the testing, which he didn't, and the amount of EDTA in the blood. But even given that, he testified under oath, May 95, that he found something consistent with EDTA in the blood. Now think about what I'm saying. You have to kind of back up and think. The prosecution set this in motion. They had every interest in the world in bringing this guy onto the stand and saying there's no EDTA in the blood. But he couldn't do that. He could not say that because they found it. So the defense called him, and he testified that it was in there. So you found the stick, you found the bag, you found the EDTA in the blood. In the spring, winter of 1995, the LAPD Internal Affairs Office conducted an internal affairs investigation of Mark Furman, because stuff was coming out about him that was really worrisome to them. Several people came forward and talked about how he had spoken with them about seeing Nicole Simpson's breast up close and personal. That he had clearly been in her presence on certain occasions and clearly had some kind of relationship with her. And I'm not suggesting they were intimate. I want to be very clear about that. I was told that he was her cop on the force, and whenever she had a problem, she would call him, and he would, you know, try to get involved in some way, so that when he went to the crime scene on that night, the only thing that was in his mind was O.J. had to do this, and I better have some damn good evidence if I'm going to make the case on this. And that was his motivation. So, all four pieces of there are lots of other pieces of information I won't go into, but all four of those checked out. And then when O.J. was acquitted, some of the jurors talked about, you know, the EDTA and the blood, how the blood was planted. And if this evidence doesn't hold up, other evidence doesn't either. So if you go back to the Howard Stern clip, you have people talking to hundreds of thousands of people, maybe millions. I don't know what his audience is, but over a period of time, it would be a lot. Talking about things they know absolutely nothing about. It's wrong. It's wrong on every level. It's totally irresponsible. And there's a lot of stuff on their hands. And they're sitting there on their butts talking about something. I mean, I've written 25 books and 13 true crime books. I've been in courtrooms and prisons all over this country. I am in some cases sympathetic to prosecutors because they deal with some very bad people who need to be locked up. But in this case, it went the other way. And it was just absolutely wrong for people to go on radio, go on television, go on the Internet, if people had the Internet back then, and say that they knew what happened. You had to go below the surface of this crime. This was a pivotal moment in American media history where everything became entertainment, everything. And it's just a bunch of laughs and yucks, you know, to say that this guy committed a double homicide. He's guilty without a trial. He's guilty without the examination, cross-examination of evidence. He's guilty without hearing from witnesses and testimony. I know the truth, and nothing else matters. But people often say, how did America get dumbed down? You know, how did we get to that place? I'm suggesting very strongly that some of it starts right there. That these people have no accountability, no responsibility of any kind, and they misled the public right from the beginning.
Context of white supremacy, our guest, Mr. Stephen Singular.
The thing is that I don't think Howard Stern's a white supremacist, right? I don't think Robin Quivers is. I mean, I think she's African American.
Right.
Right. So I don't think these people are racist, but you can unconsciously contribute to racism by running your mouth like that and not giving somebody due process. And what story have we had in the last 25 years over and over and over again? Police shooting minority suspects, police planting evidence, police exhibiting racism over and over and over again. The very same issues that were here, the very same issues that could have been examined in the trial of the century, and you have people like this saying, oh, there's nothing to it.
Mark Furman's a swell guy.
They brought in witnesses. Yeah, they brought in witnesses quoting him saying, I want to round up all the African Americans and burn them to death. That's who he is. So, no, Howard Stern is not a racist, but you have to be a little bit aware of what you're doing when you're given a public microphone at that level and you start to run your mouth about it.
You and your book, Legacy of Deception, you talk that you, in the interest of justice, you reached out to the prosecution as well, and they weren't very receptive to what you had to say either. They were pretty locked on Mr. Simpson as being the lone suspect in this case. And you write specifically, you talk about when Chris Darden was added to the team. I thought this was foul. Just share a little bit with the listeners. You write, later that day, while Cochran was still cross-examining Detective Lang, Chris Darden became visibly upset over some of the questions the defense attorney was asking and the manner in which he was posing them. A sidebar conference was called, and during the course of it, Cochran made a remark to the effect that the prosecution hadn't tried a case in a long time and didn't know how to go about it. Darden, who had been increasingly edgy, finally exploded. In a tremendous voice and swaying with anger as he stood at the podium, he was barely able to control himself. Judge Ito, who had been remarkably indulgent toward all the lawyers, had enough. He held Darden in contempt, but on three separate occasions within the next hour, he told the attorney that if he would simply apologize to the court, the judge would waive the contempt citation. Three times, Darden refused to do this, saying that he wanted his own attorney now in order to fight the contempt charge. Judge Ito, along with probably almost everyone else in America who was viewing these proceedings, was clearly beside himself with frustration. He looked like an exasperated parent in an overcrowded nursery, and for a while it seemed that the trial would come to a dead stop. After another lengthy sidebar, Darden agreed to offer the court an apology and eventually did so. The judge gracefully returned the apology, and the case resumed its glacial pace. Watching Darden being masterfully baited over and over again by Cochran during the trial, I felt sorry for him. Here was an African American who was using his education, his intelligence, his intuition, his street smarts, and everything else at his disposal to convict a very prominent member of the African American community, and he was attempting to do this based on certain pieces of evidence that had been collected by a police officer who several years earlier had reportedly told a woman that he wanted to burn black people everywhere. No wonder Darden's voice shook when he addressed the judge. While observing the attorney in the courtroom, I was reminded of how Muhammad Ali had once fought Sonny Liston, Floyd Patterson, and other less gifted black boxers in the 1960s and 70s. Ali understood the damage that racism had done to these men, understood it so deeply and so well that he knew precisely how to undermine their confidence before they ever stepped into the ring with him. A comment about them to reporters, a hint that they didn't have as much racial pride. I will stop there. Darden is a fascinating figure in all of this. Can you just give a few, particularly if we're thinking, wow, the evidence suggests Mark Furman really did plant this information, and then you've got Christopher Darden, black male, in here trying to say that, yeah, Furman didn't plant it. This is legit. OJ did this. Any extra thoughts, what you have to say with Mr. Darden?
Well, I tried to deal with him on several occasions during the trial, and he seemed very afraid of me, like this guy, kind of a loose cannon, you know. He knows stuff that, you know, could be damaging to our case. And so when the trial was over and OJ was so easily acquitted, I called him up and I said, why don't you start a real murder investigation now? Why don't you look at both victims, not just Nicole Simpson? You know, why don't you look in the money connections? Why don't you look into drug connections? Why don't you look into the people around Goldman? You know, Brett Kanter, who was a friend who gets his throat slit in July, I believe, of 93. And then Goldman dies in 94 summer, and then summer of 95, Michael Nigg, a guy from Colorado in the drug world, gets killed. All three are unsolved murders. Any murder investigation that was actually done, and this murder investigation ended at 6 a.m. on June 13, 1994, when Furman walked in with a glove, any murder investigation would have taken them in all of these other directions, especially around the subject of money. And there's a very good chance that the case would have been solved, you know, fairly easily. But none of that ever happened. And I told Darden this, and he, you know, he was just steaming. He didn't want to hear it. I mean, you gotta think about that. You put on a case for 9 months, 8 or 9 months. You spend around $10 million of the public's money, and you get, you know, run out of the courtroom and after the jury deliberates for 2 hours. I mean, that just doesn't happen. So yeah, he has a lot to answer for. You know, and he writes in his book, he devotes 5 pages to myself and the book proposal in EDTA, and he brings it up, and he says, I wonder how much Simpson paid for a defense that actually came from a true crime writer. But he never follows through on the EDTA. He never tells you what happens. He never talks about the FBI or what went on in the crime lab in the FBI and why those three people filed a complaint against the agent who testified because they felt it wasn't true. So the scandal here is much, much deeper than just, I mean, you think the scandal in the LAPD is pretty big for covering up for Furman, but it goes right to the feds too, you know, and we need to know more about that. We need to get to the bottom of that.
Didn't Christopher Darden get fired?
Trying to prosecute this guy was across the board.
Didn't Christopher Darden get fired, though?
I thought he quit. And he went on and wrote a book and made millions of dollars. That was my understanding.
I know. I have in contempt, absolutely. I was chuckling because I did read the section where he talks about you very briefly this week. But I think, one, he got fired the first time after the glove debacle and they put him back on the team. And then after it's all over, at least there's an article.
Yeah, that's true.
There's an article that's out that he was actually terminated, that he did not resign from the DA's office, that he was actually fired after the case is over. I don't know. I did see that. I know he would stop working there right after the case, whether he was fired, whatever. That would, you know, just add a different wrinkle to it. But I wanted to go back as well, because when you talked about Mark Furman and perhaps he made 2 trips to Mr. Simpson's location at Rockingham, He goes to, first he's the detective that gets to the murder scene at Bundy, and you think maybe he goes over, let's see if we can find some incriminating evidence. Rosa Lopez says she hears some voices. Howard Stern, he has a big segment talking about this Rosa Lopez and no Ricordo, and she's talking Mr. Johnny. She's totally coached. She's not believable. Like, get out of here. That's nonsense. She doesn't know what she heard or what have you. A lot of people would say she's not credible. You think her saying that she heard some voices outside after Mr. Simpson's flight had taken off, you think that that's important and credible?
Furman went over to her, knocked on her door that morning after coming back the second time, and she told him her story. She said, I heard these men arguing at 3 o'clock or so. And he said, well, I'll get back to you on that. And he never came back. Do you actually think someone would put themselves in the position of Rosa Lopez if they didn't have something to say? I mean, all you do is get trashed by every clown like Howard Stern out there. You know, I mean, that's what she went through. She was absolutely ridiculed. She went back to El Salvador. I don't know if she ever came back. I mean, they did everything they could to humiliate her. What incentive did she have to come forward and talk to a police officer, not to the Simpson defense team, but to the police detective, and say, this is what happened? I would suggest she had very little incentive unless she, you know, had something to say.
I thought the commentary about hearing those voices and Furman coming over to talk to her, I thought that was the most important thing. I thought that was more important than her saying whether or not she saw the Bronco or anything else. Like, really? What an interesting report that this guy... Can we get records on that conversation? All of that, like, super important, and that kind of just got thrown to the wayside. You have a fascinating section in your book, Legacy of Deception, where you talk about the exchange between F. Lee Bailey, who was just on the program with us about 2 weeks ago, and Mark Furman.
Yeah.
Just to give folks a tad of the exchange. So this is right in time. This is from, you're talking about what happened March 13th, the audio segment we heard from Howard Stern. That was from March 16th, so 3 days after this. But you write, the following Monday, the prosecution finished with Furman, and the moment trial observers across the nation had been waiting for had finally arrived. F. Lee Bailey approached the podium and began cross-examining the detective. The general expectation was that if the detective had something to hide, the legendary attorney would eventually wear him down and squeeze it out of him. The contrast between the two men was vivid. Bailey was older and heavier. His courtroom delivery seemed overly dramatic, and his moral indignation came across as forced and rehearsed. He appeared to have lost a beat or two in his rhythm. At times, he meandered. Furman was soft-spoken and calm, the very definition of a cool and in-control professional witness. He was tall and handsome, with clear skin, graying hair that was neatly cut, and tasteful clothes. He had a charming, rather boyish grin and easily made jokes about himself. They said that about Cato, too. His courtroom manners were impeccable. He regularly looked at the jurors and smiled. He seemed like the nicest man in the world. That's what Howard Stern said. Exactly the sort of person citizens wanted their police officers to be. He's either the best witness I've ever seen, one radio talk show caller said during Furman's testimony, or he's a psychopath. Which did you conclude, Mr. Singular?
Well, I don't necessarily like labels like psychopath. I mean, it's a kind of a slippery word, but just somebody who said on tape, you know, we beat minority suspects until our pants are covered with their blood. We want to eliminate black people, at least in the United States. How close does this sound to what was in the Turner Diaries?
Mm.
And the men who killed Alan Berg? It's note for note, basically. You know, he wanted genocide against minority people. So you draw your own conclusions. He was very capable of acting calm and in control. But what was captured on tape or in conversation with other people was a violently racist, dangerous human being whom it was said of that he did collect, you know, Nazi memorabilia. I can't prove that, but that's what was said.
Nazi Christmas ornaments, no less. I mean, wow.
Yep.
Wow. Like, this is a rare find indeed. I was going to get a few of our callers, but I want to, you mentioned this before in terms of, for Furman, he knew Nicole Simpson. You emphasized, I'm not saying that this was some sort of sexual arrangement, anything like that, but there are rumors, yep, officers saying that, hey, he's commented about her breast augmentation. He was the officer who went to Rockingham to respond to a domestic abuse incident in 1985. So he had met these two. He knew she was married to O.J. Simpson. It would just be a matter of, as you said, was Mark Furman her go-to enforcement officer she could contact to solve little problems and things? Just emphasizing that, as well as there's so many people who said, man, Furman used to talk about he did not like so-called interracial couples. If I see a black guy with a white woman, oh, I'm going to stop him. I make, yep, something up. If you have him coming to the crime scene with the mentality of, oh, I know who did this. OJ did this. He's a no good abusing Negra, yep, and he's not supposed to be with a white woman anyway. And he's got all this money he'll get away with. I'm going to make sure we get him. That sort of mentality I can, yep, totally understand. Like, oh yeah, I'm going to get this stick and boop, yep, and boop, boop, boop. Can you, any extra commentary on that one, Mr. Singular?
No, I think that's very accurate. I think you laid it out really, really well. You know, I mean, again, there's that, if you look, go back to the Alan Berg book, go back to the Turner Diaries, go back to all of that, one of the core beliefs of those white supremacists is, you know, no black men with white women. I mean, it just runs through the whole thing. And here was an example of him saying, you know, if I see an interracial couple, I'll find something to pull them over for. So, I mean, it's just note for note. You know, that's who he was. And the reason I was given the information that I was not just to be involved in the O.J. Simpson case, but to try to expose some of these, you know, cancerous, racist cops, you know, operating in big city police departments and the corrosive effect they have on everything. And I was told, you know, if you can get this out during this trial, which will be the most watched criminal trial ever, you know, it can have an impact. But I wasn't able to do that because the media, you know, after saying he was guilty for 9 months, and then the jury came back and said he's not guilty, they kept saying, yeah, he's guilty. That's how your media functions. Totally dysfunctional. Totally unwilling to look below the surface of this crime and piece together more of what really happened.
Hmm. I'll give out the number if folks have questions they would like to ask Stephen Singular, 720-716-7300, the code 564-943-pound. Press star 61 if you would like to participate. We'll see if we can get questions from some of the folks who dialed in. Let's see. Red in Ohio. Did you have a question for Mr. Singular?
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you. So I just have a couple questions. I did actually just get done reading Mr. Furman's book, and I've been reading Mr. Singular's book, which kind of helps to corroborate some of the things that Furman was mentioning in his book, especially about the stick and some other things, at least Furman mentioning that it was him who kept pointing out everything and everybody else was just basically inept to do an effective job. The first question I had, and I already finished Mr. Tubin's book, but when I was looking up information about Tubin's book, because it seems like some of the things that he's saying is contradicting others' books, which makes sense, depending on your stance about it. His book is qualified or classified as a true crime, and you mentioned you've written true crime books. So is there like a criteria of how much truth has to be in a book for it to be a true crime, quote-unquote, nonfiction book?
Well, the book business, like every other business, is a business, you know. And they perceived, the publishing world perceived, or some parts of it, that they could make money from Furman's story because, like Howard Stern, they thought, oh, he's so put upon, he's a victim of circumstances. And so the answer is no, not really. The real big point here is that what I was involved in, starting in August of 94, and then the book proposal comes to the surface in November of 94, and it goes into the hands of major media, as I said, New York Times, LA Times, et cetera. And then when the FBI, after they tested the blood in February of 95, March, and that came out in the courtroom in late April of 1995. And my name and my participation in the case surfaced for a couple of days. And I was contacted by every major media outlet in the United States, essentially, the newspapers, TV, some radio. And I told the story that I'm telling here. And everybody ignored it. Everybody was prejudiced. When you use the word racist, it's what I said earlier, you know, I don't think Geraldo Rivera is a racist. You know, I don't believe that. You have to be aware of what you're involved in and what your participation is, or you can create a lot of damage. The major media had this information in May of 95. I laid it all out for them. 5 months later, OJ is easily acquitted. How many of those reporters do you think called me back and said, you know, all the things you were saying came out in the trial? How many? Zero. So there's a great deal of complicity in this whole saga, this sad American saga, where we get dumbed down to a point that Howard Stern is the one interpreting our social, political, and criminal reality for us. He wouldn't know a courtroom from a basketball. You know, he doesn't know anything. And he turned it into entertainment. And that entertainment trickles down and it affects people. And as I said earlier, now we've had a quarter century, police brutality, police evidence planning, racism, police shootings, blah, 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 over and over again. Finally, you know, when George Floyd died in May of this year, finally, 25 years later, somebody called a timeout and said, this needs to change. We're going to pay attention to this now. It's a long-winded answer to your question, but they can sell Mark Furman. And there's an undertow of racism in all of that. Selling me is a little bit harder because I'm challenging the status quo, and I'm saying, this isn't speculation. You know, this is what happened, and this is why he was acquitted. And the jurors who were done nothing but trashed in the aftermath of that trial, shamelessly trashed, did the right thing. Because there was way more than reasonable doubt.
Well, thank you. And I know that you're not feeling well, so I won't, you know, bog you down with too many more questions, or you know, doesn't even have to be a long answer. Just the last question, because in your book, you have made a reference that you were in an interracial relationship, which I guess I kind of understood you adding that information in as to the reason why you decided to try to get this information out during the trial. Now, when I looked up pictures of your wife, because you said that you were in an interracial relationship because your wife is Hispanic, but Hispanic right. is not necessarily a race. Has that changed? Do you classify your wife, or does your wife classify herself as white, or...
No, I mean, she's Hispanic and I'm white, you know. I mean, it's a cultural difference, you know. I could talk about that for a long time, but that's not really, you know, I was made very sensitive to racial inequality and racial insults and all those sorts of things just by being married to somebody. I mean, you get much closer to that than if you weren't in that situation. So, yeah, I mean, it was a part of the motivation. It was like, this is not going to stand. We are not going to back a neo-Nazi. I mean, I'd been there 10 years earlier. I was at my first rodeo, you know. I was writing about that stuff because Furman, you know, he hated Hispanics as much as he hated black people and Jews. I mean, he was across the board racist.
Well, Mr. Singular, just to reiterate the question, because I'm just curious, because Hispanic is not a race. It's a culture. So do you or other white people, since you classified yourself as white, consider your wife white? Because even based on the 2000 census, it breaks up the Hispanic. You can be Hispanic, white, Hispanic, black, so forth. And that'll be my
we're in an area where I don't really have any expertise, and I don't like to talk about things that I really, when I don't know what I'm talking about. The way it's always been presented to me from my wife and her family is that that's an ethnic group. So maybe race is the wrong word. I mean, maybe I used the wrong word. So, but I don't really know that much about that technically.
All right. Well, thank you so much for answering my questions. Thank you.
Much obliged, Red in Ohio. Let's see. Our caller, B in Toronto. Did you have a question for Mr. Singular?
Yes. Hi. Greetings to you, guest, and greetings to your guest. I had a couple of quick questions. The first being, there was a theory or an understanding that Mark Furman had applied for a mental disability in which he claimed he was homicidal. I just wanted to find out if there was any credibility to this, and if so, then why was he still allowed to continue on the police force in the capacity that he was, if he was...
that's based in fact. There was a psychiatric... the police had psychiatrists, and they interviewed him. And I don't know if he used the word homicidal, but he said that he was basically dysfunctional and dangerous when he was on the street and all of that. And so it's a very, very good question. I mean, I can't answer it. It's just that apparently the psychiatrist thought he was just trying to get a pension and early retirement. And so they didn't give him that. They rejected it. But it's an absolutely excellent question, and it's based in fact.
Thank you. And then the second quick question that I had was in terms of the Ron Goldman and Nicole Brown relationship, not necessarily a sexual one, but there was also a theory of, and you've alluded to this already, that there could have been a drug connection. And the theory was, from what I remember at the time, back in 1994, when this was happening, was that you've confirmed that there were also a number of other murders that were happening. Nicole Brown at the time was known to be a heavy drug user, as well as known to be sleeping around with a lot of different partners. Ron Goldberg or Goldman was known to also be in the drug scene. And there was a theory as to whether Ron Goldman had a bad drug deal, or if Nicole Brown Simpson had a bad drug deal, and if that caused the murders. So I'm just wondering, like, were there any other murders after the murders of Nicole and Ron that also helped to substantiate that even further?
Well, as I said earlier, there was a murder in 93, Brett Kenner, a murder in 94, Goldman, a murder in 95, Michael Nigg. They were all knew each other, were all in the same circles. They're all unsolved crimes. What are the odds of that? Any murder investigation, actual murder investigation, this one was choked off at the start, as I said, would have led in the direction of money. It would have been relatively easy to follow those strands and figure that out. There were people around the whole case that were, you know, there were two murders in Miami. I don't have the details in front of me. Shortly after the murders in Brentwood, there was never a murder investigation. It isn't. I can't prove to you, you know, that I know exactly what happened. The bigger point is that if the police don't do their job, if they jump to conclusions instead of investigate, cases don't get solved, justice isn't rendered, and a lot of damage is done. And I believe that that's what happened in this case.
Thank you, and I leave the line.
There's another book called Killing Time by Donald Freed. Donald wrote his book about a year after mine, so he has more information about what you're inquiring about with names of people and other things. So if you're interested, I mean, if you read my book and you read his book, my book's basically about the framing of a defendant. And his book gets a little bit more into, if not O.J., then who did this? And it's a very good book.
Thank you.
Yep.
Much obliged to be in Toronto. Our caller 9029, did you have a question for Mr. Singular? You should be with us.
Greetings, Gus. Greetings, Mr. Singular. Thanks for coming on the show.
Hi.
One of the questions I have basically is some of the questions were asked already, but you stated earlier that you've traveled around the country and you've seen these instances of black people being framed quite frequently. And has this been a situation where have you been all around the country? Can you get into a little detail about, like, you've seen instances exactly like this?
No, cases? What I said was that I have been in prisons and written about criminal cases for the last 35 years. I've been in courtrooms, prisons, jails, not necessarily related to the racial aspect of it. But the point I was making was, when you reduce your culture on serious issues to a Howard Stern, you're damaging everything. This isn't just entertainment. People lose their lives. You know, people get damaged badly. And I don't think it's appropriate for comedians to sit around and, you know, make their bones on criminal cases unless they actually know something, because the law is complicated, crimes are complicated, people are complicated. What I also said was, from the time of O.J. acquittal, October 95, over the last quarter of a century, we have seen one police abuse, brutality, murder, racism over and over again. Not that I reported on it, but that others have. And that's the point. It's been very difficult to get people to take this issue seriously and to understand that police, there are a lot of good police and there are some bad ones. And just, you know, like in other things. But to consider all that and realize the effects it has on our society, that's what I was talking about. Nobody wanted to listen in 95. It took the murder of George Floyd and being on tape so people could actually see it and hear it. It took that to make a turning point. And I think some good, you know, good things have come out of that in terms of reform and other things. That's my point.
Just one more question. Do you think so-called white people will ever stop practicing racism, white supremacy? And I'll mute my line.
Well, you can stop it this evening if you put it in your heart to do that. You know, I mean, that's an individual choice. Just like what we see today, you know, in Washington. I mean, there are all these disgruntled, you know, white people who feel like victims of something, and they look for scapegoats. I mean, that's what people do down through history. And until you're willing to look at yourself, and until you're willing to change yourself, the answer is no. But each of us has that capacity to change himself or herself. We have that ability. We have that intelligence. We have that sensitivity. And usually, you know, it takes some shocking event or something for people to have some sort of revelation and transformation. And that's, you know, that's why I'm on this show talking about it. You know, that's why I wrote the book. That's why I updated it in 2016. It's a real uphill battle, but you can't give up. You know, you have to keep fighting, you know, for that realization that if you're involved in that kind of mentality, you know, you're harming your society.
Thank you. Just one quick, what was the book, the name of the book again, the author, Killing Time?
It's called Legacy of Deception. My name is Stephen Singular, Stephen Singular. For all the books, just go to StephenSingular.com, and there's a number of things on the website that are related to this. So, yes, that's the book. If you get the book, you want to get the Kindle 2016 Kindle Amazon book because it has updated information.
Okay. Also, the other book that you were referencing, The Killing Time, the one that you stated would be...
Killing Time. Killing Time by Donald Freed and Raymond Briggs. It's a very good book.
Thank you.
Yep.
Let's see. Our Bay Area Mom, much obliged, sir. Bay Area Mom, did you have a question for Mr. Singular, author of Legacy of Deception?
Yes, thank you for taking my call. Greetings to you and the guests, callers on the line. I wanted to know what, I remember Nicole had a friend that was living with her.
Resnick.
Yeah. So she, well, I don't know, but I remember hearing that she was, she was on drugs because she ended up in rehab, but she was selling drugs as well. So what do you know about her and this case? That's what I wanted to ask.
Well,
how do you think?
I don't know a lot about her. I know she was in drug rehab the night of the murders. And the one and only thing that OJ ever said about the case, he was very, very tight-lipped about it, because people would say, well, then if you didn't do it, who did? And he said, this crime comes out of the world of Faye Resnick, something like that. That's paraphrasing. So he obviously had his suspicions. I mean, there were drugs all around this thing. There were restaurants in West Los Angeles, where Metzaluna was, that had already been prosecuted as drug distribution points a couple years earlier. The whole thing was drenched in drugs. And so, again, if you don't do a murder investigation, you're not going to get anywhere. And that's the real sad part of this. I mean, there's a tragedy in the victims, and there's tragedy in the case not being solved and us not knowing the full truth of it. But the police officers have a job to do, and it was not done here.
All right. Thank you. I know there was a lot of mention of mafia ties and her owing money for the drugs, and she conveniently put herself in rehab the night this happened. And thank you for taking my call, and I'll mute my line.
All right. Gus, I'm sort of running out of gas here.
Okay. Do you have time for one more question before we...
One more. Yeah, okay. One more, and I better go.
Let's see. Retired firefighter in Florida, did you have a question for Mr. Singular?
Greetings, everyone. Wow, I need to apply for the lottery. I may win it. to the guests, Mr. Simpson was arrested, tried, and ruled not guilty for the crime of murdering his ex-wife and the other white male. And so since that took place, that reality took place, why haven't law enforcement continued to pursue the case and find out who murdered the two people? And also, why haven't Mark Furman also be considered a suspect in the murder, being that he's probably the only person connected with the case who has done killing? He was a machine gunner in Vietnam. And his mentionings about his connections with the wife. And those are my questions.
Yeah, well, the first question is an excellent question. And I said earlier that once the case was over, I went back to Chris Darden, the prosecutor, with some other information that I had gathered through a source and through some other connections. And I said, why don't you launch a murder investigation now? Why don't you do a real murder investigation now that this is over and he's been acquitted? And he just virtually, you know, laughed me out of the room. I mean, he went on to write a book, and I think he made $1.5 million on it saying that O.J. was guilty. So why would he have any incentive to open a murder investigation? They just turned their back on this and shut it down. It was a deep embarrassment to them. You know, not only did they lose the case, but once those tapes came out, they realized that, you know, they had lined up behind a neo-Nazi. And he embarrassed the hell out of all of them. So they had no incentive to open it. If the case was solved, it would have proved they were wrong all along. And I can't speak to Mark Furman as a suspect. I don't know anything about that. I've talked about what I know about. And, you know, but I don't know about him being a suspect.
Well, there was a multitude of white people who seemed to be concerned about the two murders. Why hadn't they put pressure on the authorities to find out who killed the two people?
A number of people have put pressure on them, but they just haven't responded. I mean, they just, you know, and this is a whole case of injustice, you know. I mean, top to bottom, you can't force a police department to reopen a murder investigation. They were given a lot of information about the case that never came out that much about who else, you know, could have been involved, but they just didn't pursue it.
So the people can't force the police department?
Well, you would have to come forward with evidence. You know, just like in the Zodiac case in the last couple of weeks, somebody kind of, you know, cracked one of the codes that he was using in his sort of crossword puzzle stuff. If you could do that, if you could advance the case in some way, somebody might listen. But I was involved in it personally. I personally tried to do that, and I couldn't get anywhere. I mean, they weren't going to listen to me. I didn't have the leverage to reopen a murder investigation.
Yeah. Well, last thing I would say, I would find when it comes to finding evidence, I would say that that's the responsibility of law enforcement is to find evidence.
It is.
Okay. All right.
No, you're right. You're absolutely right.
They say they found all the evidence.
Thank you.
OJ did it. Been talking to Stephen Singular, the author of Legacy of Deception and many other books, as I said, 25 nonfiction, hanging out with us for the evening. Not feeling well and hanging out with us anyway. We appreciate you being so gracious. That Howard Stern fella, incidentally, in the book he writes about Don Imus, but same thing basically. Howard Stern says O.J. Simpson should be hanging from a tree. He says that, in fact, repeatedly. You don't think that's him practicing racism, white supremacy, Mr. Singular?
Yep. Yep, it does. It's the imagery, all of it, is totally racist. Yep, it does.
Okay.
I mean, again, you know, the real point here is you have to take some responsibility for your own participation, you know, and none of those people did that, and they all made millions of dollars doing it, and it's an absolute travesty and tragedy. And, you know, I spent 25, 26 years trying to get other information out there, so I appreciate you having me on. I'm sorry I'm not at my best, but I've given it my best shot. So, you know, we just have to keep talking about it.
Much obliged, Mr. Singular. Take care of yourself. Keep up the work. And hopefully once you're all done, all better, maybe we can have you back on to continue chatting about the work. Thanks so much. And
that would be fine.
Thank you so much, Mr. Singular.
That would be good.
Take care of yourself.
Okay, thank you. Bye.
For sure. Evening, Stephen Singular, our guest this evening on The Cows, talking about his book, Legacy of Deception. Good old Mark Furman, The Turner Diaries. I wish I had got that. I guess I'll read that section from the book. I was going to get that portion, and even though we talked about it quite a bit, but just linking it to the Oklahoma City bombing, he writes, as hours passed, he pressed me harder. I told him he should think about a tangential connection between the recent bombing in Oklahoma City and the O.J. Simpson case. Was it possible that the white supremacist beliefs I documented 10 years ago were now surfacing in both disaffected ex-soldiers and disruptive police officers? Was it possible that one man with a bomb and a copy of the Turner Diaries could kill 169 people? Yes, sir. Or that one cop operating on a false assumption could hold an entire legal system hostage for nearly a year now? Were both of these things variations on the theme of domestic terrorism? Does anybody even postulate Mark Furman is a domestic terrorist? Like, when you think domestic terrorist, does the picture Mark Furman pop up? Whew. Weren't we seeing the emergence of social problems that went far beyond the Simpson case? Weren't we watching and feeling all around us the racial divisions, angers, and fears that still tormented America? Was it conceivable that police attitudes and behavior were adding to the violence that all of us were afraid of? That could have been written in 2020, year of the Rona, and you just could have, you know, swapped the name out or two. But different variations on the theme of domestic terrorism. Timothy McVeigh, Mark Furman. Even, I would encourage listeners to think about that. Mark Furman is like totally reformed. He had his perjury conviction expunged, multi-million-dollar book deals. He wrote about his book, Murder in Brentwood, and then wrote many, 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 many other books. True crime novelist himself, gets on television all the time, makes way more money than Stephen Singular. Nobody wants to hear Stephen Singular writing about Mark Furman as the face of, get out of here, domestic terrorists, get out of here. We don't want to hear about that. Get old Mark Furman on here. Swell fella. Get him in here and tell us about how he was killing niggers in Vietnam. Get in here, old Mark Furman. We love it. Give us some more crime. True crime. Tell us how that OJ killed up in the Butcher of Brentwood. Tell us how he hacked up that white woman. You know he didn't. He didn't plant no glove. Come on, Mark Furman. Give us another bestseller. Incidentally, he had assistance from Dominic Dune. I think we'll get to him as the trial gets started eventually in Jeffrey Toobin's book. But he had lots of help and folks who, you know, felt bad about how he had been maligned and mistreated in all of this to make sure that he has been totally the audacity, Howard Stern, the audacity to say Mark Furman's life has been ruined. Are you kidding? Mark Furman is doing better than everybody, right? Mark Furman is probably doing so well, I suspect he might not even qualify for his little Rona stimulus payout. I seriously, he'll probably get it anyway, but Mark Furman is Not lifer. I can't even think. I was trying to think when he said that somebody, a white person, can you think of a white person whose life has been ruined for practicing racism? Like, I can, who? Donald Sterling? He got $2 billion. Who? The suspected racist white woman who tackled that team? They didn't even name her until like a week later. And she still hasn't been charged. Who? I can't even think of one person. Anyway, I will say, man, Howard Stern. Now, I'm not going to say that listening to 25-year-old audio of Howard Stern will not make you universal man, universal woman. It will not. However, if there is any constructive value to learning about what happened with the O.J. Simpson case, if any aspect of that helps you understand what it means to be white, and or the system of white supremacy, what that is and how it works. White people, and this is important as well, we're talking about audio that is 25 years old, almost 26 years old now. Someone just uploaded all of this, edited and everything 2 years ago. Okay, this is not like somebody was sitting on this and uploaded this 2005, 2006, as soon as YouTube came into existence. Someone had been holding on to this for almost 25 years, uploaded it, and it's thousands, tens of thousands of listens. So that people still find this to be funny and valuable now. Howard Stern talking about what a swell guy Mark Berman is. OJ did it, and it is amazing. Like, I am not someone, I don't like listening to podcasts. I can't say that I love listening to the cows or any podcast in particular. And these are long segments. Like, we're talking 6 hour clips, right? And it'll be just them going through each day of the trial, what happened. They'll play little segments from the trial. But I mean, at the time, I'm sure, exactly as Mr. Singular said, this is millions of white people and non-white people who are listening. This is what I said. I was disgusted when Jeffrey Toobin, when he says Danny Schatzman with the LA Sentinel, a failing black publication. That's what Toobin called it, a failing black publication, that is the voice and how black people come to think about this. Howard Stern is reaching millions at the same time and saying, OJ did it. OJ did it. We got Captain Japan. That's his nickname for Judge Ito. And he rings the gong and does all the racist imitation voices of so-called Asian people. He does imitation racist character voices of the ignorant black jurists who he is so sure are going to acquit O.J. Simpson, not based on evidence or anything else, just because he's black and, you know, we're not going to convict this good black person and all that. I mean, it's what a time capsule of white supremacy racism. As I said, just hearing the way that they talk about Mark Berman 6 months before the Berman tapes come out and the amount of sympathy that they have for him. And, oh, I can't believe this. They're going to drag him out and have all these people say that he said nigger this and nigger. Oh, this is disgraceful. I feel so bad for this guy. He's such a great guy. He's such a swell dude. And he just comes out and he takes all these insults and he just did his job. I mean, what are they talking about? They're just going to come out and make up all this nonsense and have all these people come out of the woodworks and make, oh yeah, I heard it. He told me a racist joke and he called me a, oh, this is just silly. It's ridiculous. And he did it. They know he should be hanging from a tree right now. He says that multiple times. In fact, I can even pause right here. That is standard operating procedure. We've talked about it for years on the program, where white people, other than Donald Trump, no white person, regardless of what they do, is racist. They even said that Donald Sterling, even though they kicked him out of the league, almost no one. Yeah, I didn't like what he said about Magic Johnson either. You know, he talked about old Magic Johnson like he was OJ. But yeah, I don't think Donald Sterling is a racist now. You know, I don't think there's any place for him in the NBA, but I don't know if I'd call him a racist. Remember when it was Paula Deen? I don't know. Like, other than Donald Trump, no white person, regardless of what they do, is a racist. We even heard that on the program. I don't think Howard Stern is a racist. I know he's doing a lot of caping for Mark Furman and saying all these things about O.J. Simpson and Captain Japan and all that. I don't think he's a racist. I don't think he's aware. So he said O.J. Simpson should be hanging from a tree. That's not racist? Oh, okay. Well, I guess that might be. Woo, man, it's hours and hours of this. I am listening because they started off with Howard Stern. And I got that from reading Steven Stengler. He said, I used to listen to Don Imus. Do I have that? Oh, my goodness. Do I have it? Because I meant to read that portion. He talks about he used to listen to this and he thought it was funny. And he acknowledged that it was vulgar and politically incorrect and sexist and all the rest. I had to get that page to see if he called it racist. But he said, I acknowledged all of that, but I just thought it was funny. And then he said, but as this went on, I was like, wait a minute. This is not just funny. This is not just ha-ha. Like, this has an impact. This is connected to why I can't get anybody to think about this case and to move to the evidence, because everybody thinks like this. Everybody is just going along with this and being plugged with this sort of racist information all day long. I can't really enjoy this. He didn't even mention Howard Stern. He mentioned Don Imus. I just, you know, conjoined them because it's basically the same thing. But what a time capsule. I'm going to continue to weave in audio set for people that are listening to the book club. Oh man, the good stuff. The trial hasn't even started in Tubin's book yet for people in the book club. And it's not going to start tomorrow either. It's not starting, I think, until next week. So we haven't even got to the good stuff, the glove and Cato on the stand, Furman on the, we haven't even got to the good stuff in Tubin's book, but we will have lots of Howard Stern weaved in. Here they talk about, I mean, it's everything. You get to hear the entire trial and how it progressed. So they talk about the addition of Christopher Darden to the team. Wow. White people are not ignorant about racism. I don't think Howard Stern has a PhD in, what do they call it? Whiteness studies. Critical race theory. I don't think, I could be totally wrong, but I don't think he does. Even Howard Stern. Now, wait a minute. You're going to tell me that, well, that we got all these black people on the jury and we got old smooth Johnny Cochran on the defense, and then they got another black person because Johnny Cochran's whole firm has got lots of black people. So Carl Douglas and Sean, I forgot the last name. Sorry, Sean, I forgot the last name. Black female, but he's, lots of black people are with Johnny Cochran, and they're also sitting at the defense table. So you've got all these black people here and all these black people in the jury. And at the time it started out, it was only white prosecutors. And then you add Christopher Darden. He says, come on now. Come on. You just grab this black person. I don't know. Like, we got, we don't have any black. We're going to need some black people if we're going to convict. Like, everybody, other than saying racial showcasing, like, everybody is real informed about what racism, white supremacy is, how it works, and some of the different ways that we make it look like a black person might actually be in charge. That isn't the case, but we can give the appearance that, oh yes, there's a black person here with the prosecution, an equal part of the team, as we go to prosecute old Lorenthal. Whew. So many good clips to go. The way they talk about Dennis. Oh, my gosh. I cannot wait. I cannot wait. I posted one of the clips. I think the first audio segment, it's for Howard Stern. It goes from maybe February of 1995. I think it's right when the trial started. So it's like February 1995. And it goes through basically the end of the month. Black History Month, no less. Isn't that something? The O.J. Simpson trial starts in Black History Month. Like, they clowned all the way. But anyway, it starts from right there. And it is amazing just to hear the progression, particularly as the prosecution begins to lose. For people who didn't follow all of this or what have you, man, this is straight Floyd Mayweather. If you watch this, like, this is something where it's not close. This starts to look really, really bad. There's a reason the jury decided this case. What did he say? Less than 4 hours. this was really embarrassing by the time we got to the end. There, if you watch the trial, oh man, OJ is going to be free. There's no doubt about it. The prosecution has lost. They look totally whipped. It is embarrassing if you, you know, do any of the actual watching of the film, but just seeing the progression in terms of them starting out, even though they're saying from the beginning, black jury and all that, but seeing as the prosecution's case dissolves and their disgust and more the animus, the way that they talk about Judge Ito, the way that they talk about, because there are lots of non-white people all over in this case. They talk about that too. A lot of the witnesses even are non-white people. Some of the criminologists are non-white people. Dennis Fung, who's a really important witness for the prosecution. Oh, man. Case study in white supremacy racism. If you can find the audio of what Don Imus had to say, if people have forgotten Don Imus, who allegedly got fired from making comments about the Rutgers basketball team in 2006, and Cheryl Eiffel, we read her book in the book club. She said that he also made racist comments about her when she covered the White House before her passing in 2015. But Don Imus was fired. He said they were nappy-headed girls, nappy-head whatever he called them, hoes, that was it, for the Rutgers female basketball team. And he was fired. And then he got rehired by Fox, and he was on talk radio, and then he got hired to be on television by Fox, and he got all these book deals and stuff. So his life, Mark Furman, everybody, Mark Furman got picked up at Fox too. Nobody who is white gets punished for practicing racism. They get transferred and then picked up for Fox. Let's see. We'll get to folks who have a thought, what they heard from Mr. Singular. We will be here tomorrow for the book club, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. Jeffrey Toobin. I think this will be our last session before we get to the trial. Everything else for the remainder of Jeffrey Toobin's book is going through the trial. To Mark, is just, we got the jury picked. The trial is a few weeks away. Preparation for that and going over the dream team. But that'll be tomorrow, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. And we should have more OJ Days with white guests. We should have Pat McKenna, who is the investigator for the OJ Simpson defense team. In fact, McKenna is the white man who got the Furman tapes. He found Laura Hart McKinney, who is the white woman who did these recorded conversations with Mark Furman. He located her, got her information, called her up, had to sweet talk her because she too thought OJ was guilty. So he had to kind of convince her, like, wait a minute, he didn't kill them. Wait a minute, wait a minute, wait a minute, and all of that. But Mr. McKenna should be with us on the program next week, so we'll be able to have more white people if we have more questions, more details. Go get the details of even how he got the Furman tape. Should be fascinating. More OJ Days. I hope it is constructive for us to kind of do a deep dive into all of this. Before we nab the folks who dialed in, invest if you think the cows is constructive. We are listener-supported counter-racist radio. The blog racism-notes.blogspot.com. You'll see my new review of Isabel Wilkerson's Cased, second worst book ever, right on the blog. But the PayPal button is in the top right corner. We're also on Cash App, cash.app/$TheCows. Huge, colossal, enormous thanks to all the folks who invested, especially over the last year. Like, wow, people could have been purchasing toilet paper, Cheez-Its, hand sanitizer, lots of really important things with all of the hardship and ruination that has abounded. And to be listener supported and have folks still support, hopefully we are sharing constructive information and not just wasting time and energy talking about nonsense in the midst of everything. They got rioting and looting in the Capitol. We can't even certify the election results, and the Rona is running amok. Everything else that has taken place in 2021, if we are tuning in listening to the cows or anything else, it had better be extra worthy of our time and energy. For sure. Let's see. folks who dialed in, if you have comments, thoughts, questions, good question from Red. That's why reading is so important. I read Mr. Singular's book, but I guess, one, I'm reading so many books. I'm awash in O.J. Simpson literature. So I'm reading so many books. Like, oh, okay, I read that one. Moving on, reading other books. And I had almost forgotten, like, oh, yeah, he did talk about how he's in a so-called tragic arrangement and how that was a part of his motivation, because Mark Furman had made so many comments. But, oh, my God, that's an abomination, you with this nigger with a white woman. And all the rest of he even fussed at some of his other white enforcement officers who married a non-white person. Oh, my God, and put a swastika up in their locker and all the rest of this. So I do remember that, but I had forgotten. And we only had him for an hour, so I wouldn't have even got that. But have listeners who are doing some reading to be able to ask some other questions. And he even didn't don't even have the expertise to comment on the Hispanic classification. Maybe that's an ethnicity. Maybe it's a racial classification. I'm not even informed enough to comment. That was fascinating right there. But he does write about that in Legacy of Deception. Folks who dialed in with a hand up, did you have commentary?
Can I be heard?
Red in Ohio. Yes, ma'am.
Yes, thank you so much for, you know, pointing out that question that I asked, because it was kind of, it was like he was just using buckets of words. And when I was, because I have the audiobook, and when I was listening to the audiobook, and when he digressed into that part, I was thinking, why are you mentioning that? Because all he said was, you know, I'm in an interracial relationship, and she's Hispanic. But then when I looked up the picture, because he does have a picture online, it's like this person is, I don't think that this person will be classified as a quote-unquote non-white Hispanic, almost the same complexion as he is. So I thought that was kind of interesting, and he brought it up because he was talking to his son about, you know, kind of like the injustices, and at least, you know, he was somewhat forthcoming, like, you know, reluctantly forthcoming that it was an ethnicity. But to mention, to just say, oh, well, I must use the wrong word, and then for him to mention, oh, well, the stuff has been updated, it seems like that was definitely deceptive, to say the least, because I feel like white people, they do have a very skilled use of words. The other thing, even with the question about the true crime, because I had just recently, when I was just doing some little back research on Tubin's book, and when I was doing that back research and just recently found out that his book is classified as a true crime, like, I guess, you know, I don't know how, what qualification, and just at least trying to get some of that information, but it almost kind of goes against his qualification, his book, or, you know, even like his information being classified as true crime, because Tubin said a lot of things that were like deceptive or basically omitted a lot of information, because when I first started reading his book, it almost kind of was, I found myself kind of changing my mind about whether OJ was guilty or innocent, but then I had to keep, you know, doing additional research. So definitely I suggest not to just Mr. Tubin's book, especially if you're as ignorant about the case as I am. And the one other thing that I wanted to mention is, it seems like no one is really speaking about Mark Furman, and I forgot the woman who recorded him when he was when she was supposedly, quote unquote, doing like this screenplay for Men Against Women, that group.
Laura Hart McKinney.
Laura Hart McKinney. It's like nobody is mentioning that her and Furman had a sexual relationship. And I didn't find that out until later on in Furman's book, that he finally said, oh, well, we had a sexual relationship, but we decided to just not go further with actually solidifying it with like dating or, you know, even an engagement or anything like that. So that would really go against her credibility, Laura Hart McKinney's credibility, that, you know, saying the tapes were just a work of fiction. Because why would you want to tell on your ex-lover if you knew how racist he was? Then I don't know if maybe she doesn't want to, you know, be implicated in his act of terrorism. And I'll mute my line. Thank you.
Indeed, she testifies at the trial, Laura Hart McKinney, for a number of days, in fact, about, you know, hanging out with Mark Furman, how they met and all the rest of it. Incidentally, Mr. Furman, I mean, he's a convicted perjurer, so it is difficult. He seems like I could easily see him being one, like it wouldn't be, at least for me, it seems like it wouldn't be a stretch for him to be one of those fellows who lies about his sexual exploits, right? Like, he's going around, oh, I slept with her. Oh, yeah, I slept with her. Oh, yeah, I slept with her. Totally could be true. But also, since he is a convicted perjurer, I could see him being the type of person who just lies about, you know, all of these sexual conquests. But either way, even if they did have some sort of sexual arrangement, I think, I don't know if this comes out in Tubin's book, I believe there are reports that she attempted to speak with him. Like, it wasn't like she volunteered to come out and hand these tapes over. Like, they had to go through a subpoena. Like, it was a lot of wrangling to get these tapes from Laura Hart McKinney. So it wasn't like she immediately snitched on him, like, oh my God, this Furman guy's, I got tapes of him talking about planting evidence and hating interracial couples and all that. Like, bam-o, let me hook you up, John. That didn't happen. So, much obliged, Red in Ohio. Other folks who have commentary, thoughts, line should be open. Proceed.
May I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, I appreciate him coming on the show, because I have to be honest, I didn't expect exactly what the caller just spoke about before. I had no knowledge that Furman had a relationship with Nicole Kidman. I had no knowledge about that. I did, however, hear knowledge and information about Ronald Goldman and Nicole Kidman, and a lot of them being entrenched in a lot of drugs, money, and sex. I've heard that repeatedly, but I thought it was just a rumor as well. So he did clarify some things and gave some information to look into as far as the killing time. But when he asked about the question, do you think, you know, white people will stop practicing racism, he went on for a real long time, until finally, in the middle of what his statement, he said, no, I don't think we'll stop. No, I don't think white people will stop. But then he kept on going on explaining how it's in people's hearts to make the decision. And it became a little jarred and confusing as he kept on speaking about that. And when asked about the cases and how many cases he's seen in regards to, injustices like this, you know, happening with black people, he kind of went on the same tangent as before, and then went on speaking about 25 years since the OJ trial. Now with George Floyd, people are seeing this and, you know, they're recognizing it. And I'm just like, so this wasn't happening 25 years prior, and prior to that, centuries, if not. So, I mean, it's good that, again, it's good to have him on the show. Appreciate the information. But also, I'm glad you got the comment out in regards to Howard Stern. I don't know what he was saying, speaking about them not being Howard Stern not being racist. I just find that ridiculous. But again, it's good information. Appreciate him coming on the line. And I'm curious about the book now. He referenced Killing Time. By that other author, Donald. So, thanks again.
Donald Freed, F-R-E-E-D. Lots of OJ books. That is one of the few. Again, that's been my observation. Books like Mr. Singular's book, Legacy of Deception, Mr. Freed's book, Killing Time. I'm trying to think. There's so few where it's like, maybe OJ didn't exactly do. I think there's another one. Schiller, I think, is his name. American Tragedy, where it might be a maybe OJ didn't do it, although I think he has changed his mind and now also says that OJ is guilty. But it's a very limited number, and none of these books are bestsellers. I think the Schiller book might have done okay, but generally these books are not bestsellers. Mark Furman's book, bestseller. Marsha Clark's book, bestseller. Without a doubt, that's bestseller. Christopher Darden's book, bestseller. Books that he's guilty, he did it. Jeff Toobin's book, bestseller, made it into a big feature-length film. Any other folks comment? Oh, it is Nicole Brown Simpson, not Nicole Kidman. She is a big-time Hollywood actress. The Furman and Nicole Brown.
My fault, I mix up by white people.
Yeah, hey, happens to the best of us. The commentary, the speculation about Nicole Brown Simpson and Mark Furman. There's lots of hinting, rumoring about that. They definitely knew each other. I guess it would just be how much of a relationship, how much contact did they have with Nicole Brown Simpson and Ronald Goldman. There's a lot of speculation about sexual activity between those two as well. His family members. Now, they, in my view, do have a vested interest in how they want to portray their family member, deceased family member. So I could see where they would want to say, oh no, he's not involved with this fellatio giving drug using white woman, he's not, they're just friends or whatever, he just knew her. I could totally see them wanting to squash that. They've said he wasn't in a relationship or anything. I do at least think for the night in question, the night of the murders, June 12th, the evidence, the testimony, even we heard F. Lee Bailey, he said the children who state her daughter and son, they were supposed to have a playmate over for the evening. The playmate surprisingly left at some, I think he said around 9, maybe a little bit later. Schadenfreude, incredible for her. She leaves, but up until that point, she's under the impression that she's not only going to have her two children, she's going to have an extra child there. The report is that Ronald Goldman was supposed to be meeting a friend the night of the murders, that he was going by Nicole Brown Simpson's residence, drop off the glasses. He's supposed to be going someplace else. Now, it could have been, hey, come with me to this place, even though that seems kind of weak, at least for me, because she's got the two children there, and it was supposed to be 3. The other child had just left, within the hour. So that seems a little, and then maybe it could be she can convince him. We're going to have a bath. I got my little lingerie on, skimpy black dress thing. Maybe she can convince him not to go do that. Maybe so. But at least there's some evidence that he was not going to stay there. He had plans to be elsewhere. And like I said, the fact that there was that extra child there, at least in my view, unless this was a spontaneous type of thing, like, oh, wait a minute, the extra child is not here. Maybe I could get Ron to, hang out and fool around once he drops the glasses off. Maybe, but there is some evidence that Ron Goldman was not going to be hanging out. He was just going by to drop off glasses and then going on his way. That does not negate that they could have been in some sort of sexual arrangement. Lots and lots of rumors about that. Beyond the rumor, the drug use with those two, I don't think there's any rumor on that at all. I think that's pretty well substantiated with Nicole Brown Simpson. I think lots of folks, OJ Simpson, Nicole Brown Simpson, Ron Goldman, all of these, the frickin' mob members testified at the trial. Like, I didn't even know that. And I think some of these folks had connections to the Goldman family. Like, it is crazy. Like, it was like, for real? But like, yeah, the Fiato brothers testified at the trial. And in fact, they turned the cameras off for this portion because they're in witness protection program. Like, woo, wackiest thing ever. But lots that you can research there, did other folks have commentary?
Hi, Gus.
Be in Toronto. Yes, ma'am.
Yes. I also wanted to add too that the connections extend even further because Wasn't Robert Kardashian's wife, Kris Kardashian, now Kris Kardashian Jenner, Nicole Brown Simpson's friends, one of her close entourage, who was also involved in the drug situation as well. So I mean, it's and many others. So it's just quite interesting, and the fact that I forgot the woman's name, but the one that was reluctant to relinquish the Mark Furman tapes. It kind of reminds me of that no snitch policy that is entrenched in the white code or white pathology. It's interesting all around how the Los Angeles Police Department just chooses not to pursue a case to solve the crime, that they would much rather. Absolve themselves of their duties rather than worry about their image rather than do their jobs. So that was quite insightful. Thank you.
For sure. For so many reasons, I think, like, if somebody else did this, even if they confess to it, like, what does that mean for all of that? I think they spent millions of dollars, or it's not even a thing, they spent millions of dollars on this trial and insisted and stood up for and covered for Mark Furman and all the rest of it. Like, what a it's beyond even colossal embarrassment. I mean, if you would do this to O.J. Simpson, what does that mean for the rest of us? Like, O.J. Simpson, who was, you know, metaphor forgive, but I mean, LeBron James, you know, Kobe Bryant, like, really, really popular and beloved, doing movies and commercials and all the rest of it. Like, to do this to O.J. Simpson, like, who is doesn't even talk about racism. He's like the furthest you can get from. He wouldn't be caught dead with Al Sharpton or Jesse Jackson. Like, if he would do such a thing to O.J. Simpson, like. And I can't stress enough, this is not the first time where white people falsely accuse a black person and the real culprit, sometimes the real killer, get out of jail free card, get out of prosecution, anything, because we got a nigga that we're going to blame this on. So, you know, hey, that's why we're reading Last Man Standing next about Geronimo Gijaga Pratt, because it's the exact same case where you have a black male where you know he didn't do this crime. You have evidence that he didn't do this crime, and 25 years hanging out in prison. We don't even make an effort to pursue the real killers. 25 years, we just insist, oh yeah, this nigger did it. He did it. Absolutely. We know he didn't do it. And in the exact same location, the great state, the golden state. But I mean, that is over and over again. The case of Picking Cotton, the book, where they talk about Matthew Cotton, black male who was wrongly convicted and jailed for raping a white woman, where he was totally innocent in prison for a long time, for they exonerated him through DNA evidence that, oh, he didn't do it. But this sort of thing has happened repeatedly. But I was that I can't vouch for it being a case where they knew he didn't do it and they allowed the killer wrong. But there have been too many of those cases where they knew this black person didn't do it. And, oh, well, we're just going to blame it on him and the real culprit, killers, rapists, whatever it is. Yeah. Oh, well, free to commit other crimes, kill other folks, rape other people, whatever it is. We got any nigger will do, as they say, any nigger will do. I think Hurricane Carter, I think that might be another one. We'll pin this crime on him. And, oh, well, somebody else that, oh, well, any nigger will do. Any other folks have commentary? multiple OJ days this week. We'll be here tomorrow for Jeffrey Toobin's book. Again, he'll be explaining the Dream Team and all of that, how OJ Simpson's prosecution, or excuse me, how his group of attorneys came together, and a lot more background information on F. Lee Bailey, his time in Ohio. He was talking about that when Red called in. We'll get a lot more information on his case with Sam Shepard and all of the Alan Dershowitz, all the folks who fill out the I think Barry Sheck and all those other folks. But that'll be tomorrow. Again, we'll have Patrick McKenna on the broadcast next week, and we can ask him, because like I said, this was not Laura Hart McKinney. She's the white woman with the tapes. B was talking about the no snitch code. We'll be able to ask him, because this trial went on for 9 months. You can even think about that. If this trial had been a bit more brisk, normal pace of a trial, we probably would not have got the Furman tapes, because those did not come out. They had to grapple, like she went to court. That's what I mean. This was not a Laura Hart McKinney is about justice. Laura Hart McKinney is about doing the right thing. And I see this guy, Mark Furman, on the stand every day. Oh, I've never called anyone a nigger. I would never use such language. And you got 10 years worth of tape, nigger this and nigger that, and kill the nigger and nigger, nigger. This was not a, oh yeah, I gotta do the right thing. I gotta be a good citizen and, you know, let the world know what Mark Furman is really, because he even talks on the tapes about planting evidence. So yeah, no, that did not happen. Mark, as I said, the audio segment that we started with today, that was from the Howard Stern Show, March 16, 1995. She could have taken 2 months, thought about it. Double murder trial. He's committing perjury in a double murder trial. Let me do the right thing. Okay. I had 2 months to think about it. It's May. Let me step forward, give Johnny Cochran and them a call. Nope. We get to July and the case is still going on, and they find out, because I think they will have to ask Mr. McKenna to confirm next week, but I think they find out that these tapes exist and they're being shopped to the tabloids. I think she contacted an attorney not to turn them over, you know, to the prosecution. They might be relevant, but hey, maybe we can sell these, and trying to sell her a screenplay. Tabloids are making offers for like $250,000. We'll see. We'll confirm. Anyway, Mr. McKenna contacts her and is, oh, nah, I don't want to. It's we think O.J. Simpson didn't do this. You know, the time frame doesn't match up. We got all this wacky evidence and this Mark Furman. You know, we think he's lying. And I don't want to help Arethel James. What do you mean you don't want to help Arethel James? Wait a minute. Mr. McKenna, we will get a breakdown. What did that phone conversation sound like? This sound like someone who, a white woman who was concerned about justice. I want to do the right thing. It's not about if I think O.J. Simpson did it. It's not about if me and Mark Furman had a sexual relationship, or even if we're still having a sexual. It's not about that. It's about doing the correct thing. They spent millions of dollars on this trial, and we just want truth. We care about Nicole Brown Simpson. We got two dead white people here. That's what this is all about. Two dead white people and figuring out the truth of what happened. And we want truth. We don't want people up here lying about what they did or didn't do. Let's get all the truthful information so that we can make a correct decision. Pursue justice. Is that what happened with Laura Hart McKinney? Or did we get a whole lot of wrangling? Because I think this was a whole lot of wrangling. Like, I don't think even when Mr. McKenna talked to her and was like, no, he didn't do this, man. This evidence is bogus, man. They got planted blood. We got EDTA and all the rest of it. Like, no way. Absolutely not. It's no way he could have done all that. I don't think it was, oh, okay. That seems reasonable. I'll at least, you know, submit the tape. I don't think it went like that, because they had to go to court like repeatedly in North Carolina to get these tapes brought over and all the rest. Like, whew. We will talk a lot about the Furman tapes with investigator McKenna next week, and to even see how Toobin talks about the tapes, because I've said repeatedly since we've been studying all this, I thought O.J. Simpson was guilty. I have lived since this case took place thinking he was guilty, not because I read any information, not because I watched any asset, even like
5 minutes of the trial. I did not. Not because I read any of these books prior to, you know, what we're doing right now. I didn't listen to an interview. I didn't watch a documentary. Nothing. I didn't even watch the FX series when it aired in 2016. Nothing. Just through the racist Howard Stern, Don Imus, all the rest of it, that osmosis, the FX series, the osmosis of all that. Oh, yeah, he's guilty. He did it. He did it. Mark Furman didn't plan. No, get out of here. That Mark Furman is a swell guy. They just ruined his life. Like, that's what I thought. And a big part of that, even after they did all that wrangling and grappling and had to go to court, I think all that will be detailed in Tubin's book, but we're like way far away from all that. Even after they did all that and they played the Furman tapes in court so people could hear what was on them, none of that was rebroadcast. If you were not watching court TV or CNN or whatever for that day in August 1995, you did not hear the full unvarnished Furman audio. Like, that was it. They did none of the major newspapers did a full transcription of what was said. You just got, and most of it, they just, oh, he said nigger, and, you know, it's terrible, blah, blah, blah. They don't even focus on, wait a minute, he's talking about planting evidence? He's talking about all these things with interracial couples and not liking black guys with white women? And like, whoa, like, let me see it all. Let me get the full context so that I can think about this and then think about, now, how would this fella behave given all of that? Everything that he said repeatedly, how would such a fella behave coming on this crime scene, particularly if he knows Nicole Brown Simpson, as we talked about already? If they know each other, their friends had met him, even if it's not sexual, as Mr. Singular said, even if it's just, this is my, you know, police guy, my police pal, you know, if I need any assistance or some ideas or whatever it is, I can call him. Like, if we even have that sort of rapport and he shows up and, oh, man, that no good greasy nigger OJ did this, man. I went to the Mark Furman is the one who wrote the note. Remember, we read that in Tubin's book. The only reason OJ Simpson has that conviction for that 1989 incident, he had to go around and get an officer to substantiate and say, hey, this is a problem. We should prosecute. Who wrote the letter? Mark Furman. He would have in mind, oh, yeah, we got this nigga with this white woman. Shouldn't be happening. Turner Diaries. He shows up thinking this way, like, wow, would that impact how he functions, what he's thinking about, even the conduct when they get to O.J. Simpson, when they hop the wall? Now, really, a person who's talking like this, are they really concerned about the health and well-being of O.J. Simpson? Black male, domestic abuser of a white woman. It would give you lots to think about. And I guess my last little comment on that would be, I can't emphasize enough, the jury did not hear the full Furman audio. Like, the sanitation job on the Furman tapes has been so extraordinary that, again, the only way you would have heard the unvarnished Furman tapes if you were watching court TV on that day in August when they aired in court. The jury was not present, so the jury didn't even hear all of this. It was not transcribed in any of the newspapers or what have you. And I'm not even sure. I think maybe if somebody uploaded it, maybe you can go back and find that day and see if they played it all. But I think now they have a transcript of these tapes that you could read online. But it has been so thorough that I think most people are not even really aware of what he said. It's just, oh, he maybe said nigger once or twice, and that's, you know, that's it. Like, it does not in any way capture that term psychopath. It does not in any way capture the true nature of what does it mean to be white? Who is this fella that we're talking about who is concerned about the safety and well-being of a black male? Who is it again now? Hop the fence? Lots more to come.
Whew. Cannot wait to talk to O.J. Simpson's investigator, Patrick McKenna, next week about the discovery of the Furman tapes with Laura Hart McKinney, and to see if he had any inclination or suspicions if they were in any sort of sexual activity, if that might have been a part of why she, you know, may have wanted to protect, defend Mark Furman and not easily hand over these incriminating audio recordings. Everyone satisfied? Anything else they need to get in? Are we OJ'd out for the day?
Hi, Gus.
Be in Toronto.
Just one quick thing. I'm just curious to, and this is always something I've always considered as very disturbing, is how was it that O.J. Simpson was acquitted in the criminal trial, but he is convicted and forced to pay over $33 million in the civil suit? It was just, at that time, to me, it was unheard of as to how that could possibly happen, considering all the other unknown variables that both Nicole Brown Simpson and Mark Furman were involved in.
System of racism, white supremacy, that would be my short answer. I guess the slightly more detailed answer, and I think Effley Bailey and others have talked about this, the system of white supremacy will frequently punish black people if they are deemed uppity or have gotten out of their place, or have somehow done something that racists disagree with. And so I feel like this was like with Jack Johnson, black male, won the heavyweight championship, also had feverish sexually involved with white women, and they harassed him and jailed him. The Mann Act, transporting a female across state boundaries for illegal sexual purposes. I think President Trump just pardoned him. Not recently, not within like the past couple of days, but I think he did pardon him within his 4 years in office. But anyway, this sort of thing is standard operating procedure in a system of racism, white supremacy, racist retribution. And number one, as you said, you used the word unheard of. I am not a scholar of U.S. jurisprudence. However, I have read others who have said, hey, I haven't been able to do an extensive search of every single U.S. case, but it does seem to be rare, if not unprecedented, for someone to be taken through a criminal trial, be found, be acquitted, and then be prosecuted and found guilty in a civil trial. He said most of the time, if you're acquitted in the criminal trial, it doesn't even get to a civil trial. Now, also part of the reasoning is there's a substantial difference. In a criminal trial, it would have to be a unanimous conviction or unanimous acquittal, which they had unanimous acquittal. Civil trial, it does not have to be unanimous. And it was not. It was 9-3. The civil trial, the jury, coincidentally, had 9 white people, 3 non-white people. Criminal trial, the jury had 10 non-white people, 2 white people. Criminal trial was in downtown Los Angeles. Big deal was made of that. Howard Stern talked about that for a lot. The civil trial was back in Santa Monica, different demographics, so that was part of it. The what they call threshold is substantially lower. In a criminal trial, it's supposed to be beyond a reasonable doubt for conviction. In a civil trial, it is more likely than not. So it is a substantially lower threshold to convict someone. There are many other details, many, many other, like they changed laws so that evidence that was favorable to the prosecution that would tend towards a conviction, they literally changed laws to make evidence admissible for this case. There are lots of, that's what I mean when you have white people who are intent on vengeance, like uppity Negro got over, we're gonna get him. They can literally change laws so that evidence, something that before would not even be considered evidence, now this is evidence because we say so. Lots more that could go on in terms of why he was convicted in the civil trial, not in the criminal trial. Lots more that could be said, but those are some of the details. Maybe we can ask Patrick McKenna about that next week as well.
Can I be heard?
Retired firefighter in Florida.
Yes, sir. That's part of what you just got through talking about is where my mindset was at. There were tons of white people who were intent on hearing and seeing a Renthal James Simpson being convicted and sentenced for the murder of those two white people. And with the advent of him being ruled not guilty, there is almost, even right after it happened, there's not even that, it's not even interest into the deaths of those two people. And these are white people in the case of two dead white people. They were so disappointed in the idea of O.J. Simpson not being convicted. And as I mentioned to the guests, especially white people, they have the power to make law enforcement do what they want them to do. In some cases, it's an electoral situation, and just by the sheer might of white people in itself, under the global system of race and white supremacy. If that was something that they really wanted to happen, it can happen, but they're not even interested. That's just how bad they wanted OJ, to be the actual killer, in that light, I find it pretty interesting in the intensity that white people have to get and keep a non-white person that they target, in trouble or dead. Very intense, even at the expense of other white people.
Yeah, can I comment on that shortly there?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, I think that's interesting. A very good point you make. Retired firefighter. It's basically, it seems like the thirst, and I'm using that word on purpose, that drive, so to speak, to see black male death overrides even finding justice for two lost white lives, so-called white lives. And I think that's really, that's fascinating itself. And as I was listening to you speak, I kind of remembered where I was when the verdict came out. I was in high school, and it was two things going on at that point. It was like, I think it was a Knicks game or something like that, a play finals or something. And at the same time, there was the OJ trial. And my teacher, who I deemed at the time an older white woman, a suspected racist, brought the TV in from another classroom. I think it was a video class or whatever. Put it in our room, and she's a math teacher, and brought the TV in so that the whole classroom could watch the verdict. And while we were talking, it just dawned on me. And I was like, and when the verdict came out where OJ was not guilty, she immediately looked at all of us, turned the volume down, and said, "This is what happens when injustice is quote unquote pushed out, and you have a lot of money, and you could do what you want to do." And I just found it was, I just thought it was odd how she was even pushing her quote unquote thought process and her opinions on a bunch of young high school students, and we're in math beginning, ending off our last semester, and you're bringing in the TV to show us about a murder trial. I mean, like, isn't there some kind of rules against this? Like, I just, it was just dumbfounded, but I really like that point that you make. Again, I'm going back to that about the thirst to see black male deaths at the expense of no matter how many white lives. They don't even care who died. Let's watch this quote unquote nigga fry. That's basically what it came down to. I'll mute my line.
Much obliged.
Same thing with the non-white black males out of New York. It's a similar situation.
Central Park Five.
The rape trial. Yes.
Yep. Very common.
Agreed.
Very common in the system of white supremacy. I would only say with Mr. Simpson's case, people will say that all the time. If you say O.J. Simpson is not guilty or he didn't do this, I think the reflexive response will frequently be, who did do it? And I think, as was stated, that is the job of the enforcement officers to figure out who did this. Even though I think for a substantial number of white people, they just said, hey, O.J. Simpson did it. In fact, F. Lee Bailey, he said he has concluded that for a number of white people, it just became O.J. Simpson did it. If he didn't do it, I don't care and don't want to know. O.J. Simpson did it. So if you have that sort of attitude, I mean, hey, it's not going to be he did it and that's that. We feel like justice is, you know, let's prosecute him in the civil trial, you know, whatever we need to do there, and then find anything else. You know, we'll prosecute him for stealing his property in 2007 and then find, you know, anything else that we can do to attack him and persecute him until we deem, you know, they might come around with some other charges. He's still alive. Who knows? But that, for a lot of white people, that is justice. You know, that's what. And I would even submit the lack of concern for Nicole Brown Simpson, for Ronald Lyle Goldman, Nicole Brown Simpson. It's so flagrant in this case. Not that people are upset, like, oh man, they died and their killer, Orenthal James, got away with it. No. These folks are up complaining, and this is not even like in the tabloids. This is like in the LA Times. This is a review for Tubin's book. And they were saying that there's not really anything else to say about all this. Tubin's book was published in 1996, so it's a year after the criminal trial. And I think at this point, the civil trial starts at like the end of 96. So it's like, you know, it's not really a whole lot else to say at this point. It's all been said. All these books are out. There are more coming, but it's not really anything else to say. And he concluded that by reading Tubin's book. Like I said, this is a review of Tubin's book while it's complaining that one of the other authors has reneged. He was committed to write a book and has said, forget it. He got like, I think, a $2 million advance and he refunded it and said, forget it. I don't even, it's nothing else to say. You know, it's all been said. I'm good. Let's move on from OJ. And so he said, Tubin's book, he said, it will be good for our purposes, for people who are reading this or want to know about the O.J. Simpson trial like 25 years later and didn't watch the trial or whatever. It'll be good for them. But for us right now who are saturated in this, we do not need this book. There's nothing in this book that you don't know if you watch the trial. That was his take on Jeffrey Toobin's book and why he concluded we do not need any more OJ books because it has all been said. But they were complaining in that report like, man, Tubin doesn't tell us about Nicole Brown Simpson's sisters and their breast jobs. He doesn't tell us how they like them. We don't get to hear any more gossip about the sexual relationships between Christopher Darden and Marsha Clark. We don't get to hear any more gossip about if Larry King was sleeping with Faye Resnick. What does any of that have to do with Nicole Brown Simpson dead? Ron Goldman dead. Like, one, necrophilia, all of this sex and lusting and who's having sex here? And all of this was Ron Goldman having sex with Nicole Brown. All of that sex around this murder and death that is
necrophilia, in my opinion. There is some, that's in the definition, some sort of sexual gratification from death. All over this in so many different ways, and it's just ghoulish, but it's no concern with, oh yeah, I feel bad about Nicole Brown Simpson and Ron Goldman, like it's terrible what happened, and that's why I'm out. Get out of here. Like, that is not what it is at all. All this is naked OJ Simpson should be hanging from a tree. That doesn't have anything to do with concern about Ron Goldman, Nicole Brown Simpson. If anything, it should be, I'm disgusted with racism. If it wasn't for racist Mark Furman, the nigga would be in jail where he should be. That wasn't the response that I heard. Not, man, we need to get rid of racism immediately, and or we need to clean up our act. We're not going to have any more incompetent criminal work. You're going to put your booties on. You're going to put your gloves on. We're not messing around with this anymore. We're going to do this competently. So it's never going to be that we messed around and didn't, you know, collect the samples properly and didn't do no. There was some of that. Don't get me wrong. There was some of that. But I mean, most of it was, forget all of that. That Negro O.J. Simpson and that no-count Negro Johnny Cochran, they finagled and race-carted us to death, and oh, it's an outrage, and we'll fix his wagon. That's mostly what I saw, not we're going to get Mark Furman. It's your fault that all this came. It's your fault, Furman tapes and all the rest of the, we are going to fix your, no, that didn't happen.
The other aspect I just wanted to point out was just the profit that you mentioned earlier, is how much everybody else profited from basically their deaths and OJ's quote unquote case. Everybody's made so much money. I mean, and even till today, you still may hear a comedian or two make a joke about, you know, the OJ Simpson case. Like it's something that is basically living in infamy. It's not going anywhere. As far as historic wise and a part of this so-called culture, and everybody still to me made off well outside of OJ, you know, and obviously the two, you know, dead white people.
Christopher Darden didn't make out too well in all this either. Like,
really?
I struggle. Oh no. Oh, well, I mean, he did get a book. He did get to make millions of dollars from his book, but I mean, it would be really, you have to hear, like, if we get to the end of the book club, I'll ask, you know, how people think. I'm conceding that right there. He wrote a book. I have it. In Contempt, New York Times bestseller. He got millions of dollars. Even with that, in my view, my conclusion, and it's not even anything I have to think about, Christopher Darden did not come out of this well, like, at all. Not even close. I wouldn't care if he got, we would have to be maybe talking like billions. I'd be like, well, okay. But I mean, if it's just he got like $5 million off it, like, man, nah, not even close. Total victim, like, wow. And I mean, I struggle with empathizing for Christopher Darden, not because he got $5 million. Like, that's, for all this, like, come on, that's an insult. I struggle with empathizing with Christopher Darden because the whole glove debacle, which we've not gotten to in the book yet, but I mean, infamous, which he is blamed for. Talk about racial showcasing. There have been so many excuses. It's so embarrassing about all of this. I'm embarrassed that I believed all of this for so many years. But with the gloves, they have said that O.J. Simpson was exercising his fist muscles. O.J. Simpson wasn't taking his arthritis medication. O.J. Simpson was acting. O.J. Simpson wouldn't straighten his hand. The gloves shrank because it had been, I think, a year or a year and a half since the murders, and they were covered in blood, so they shrank maybe 15 to 20%. I mean, they got more excuse. The dog chewed on them. They got excuses. Termites got into the lab. They got all these excuses
for why the gloves didn't fit O.J. Simpson. So fast forward, and this is during the trial. Everything I just mentioned is in the – I'm so embarrassed that I believed all of this by osmosis. So fast forward to 2012. Johnny Cochran dies in 2005. 2012, the excuses are still coming out as to why the glove didn't fit. So we get to 2012. Now it's Christopher Darden reportedly charges that Johnny Cochran manipulated the evidence. He took the gloves, the defense asked to see the gloves, and they manipulated them somehow or did something with the inner lining so that that would make it impossible or prohibit Mr. Simpson from getting his hand all the way in the glove. That you are charging deceased Johnny Cochran with criminal activity. You're saying he tampered with evidence. Why didn't you make this charge during the trial? I mean, that's serious. Why wait until he's been dead 7 years to then come out and say, like, I find that to be the height of tackiness, especially this is someone that you affectionately called stepdaddy. This is someone that you said, hey, helped mold me and helped inspire me and how to think of myself as a black prosecutor. He had the job that I once had working at the district attorney's office and all of this. I'm going to wait until he's been dead 7 years. He's not even alive to respond to these allegations to make up some nonsense about these gloves 20 years after the, like, really, Christopher, like, that is like, no name calling. I mean, why did you get paid for that? Did a white person demand that you deeded that? I mean, you could just let it go at that point. Like, ah, the nigga got off. I'm done. I don't even want to talk about it. No. I got to pull Johnny Cochran in and accuse him of tampering with evidence. Like, wow. That is extra, extra, extra low. But he is a victim of racism. And even with that said, Christopher Darden did not come up. He did not do well in this at all. Not even close. Victim of white supremacy, and no other title even comes remotely close to how he should be described in all this.
Okay. Let's see.
Anyways,
I look forward to hearing the rest of the book.
Me as well. We have, I think we're not even at, the trial hasn't even started. I keep saying we haven't even got to that. Christopher Darden isn't even a character in the book yet. Like, I think he was just briefly mentioned at the beginning. And even that, we've got halfway through this book. Christopher Darden has not even been mentioned. He is a total non-factor in the first half of Jeffrey Toobin's book. But if you go back and you read the introduction, the only spot he's been mentioned thus far was any introduction where he says the prosecution lost this case because of Marsha Clark's arrogance and Christopher Darden's incompetence. We're halfway through this. Christopher Darden is not a factor at all. At all. But his incompetence. That's why I said, like, man, nothing. Victim of White Supremacy is the only title that he gets out of all of this, even though that is mighty low to dump that on a dead victim of white supremacy to say that they tampered with evidence as your explanation for the gloves. That is, whew, wow. Any other commentary? We'll be here tomorrow for the book club 7th session, picking up just how did O.J. Simpson's team, more detail about F. Lee Bailey, Alan Dershowitz, all of the members. There might even be some mention about Patrick McKenna. I'm not sure. Says he's one of the investigators for the team. He got the Furman tapes. He should be with us next week. We'll see if they detail him, but we will be here tomorrow, hopefully worthy of your time and energy. Much obliged for folks tuning in this here evening. Again, sobriety would be best. They just had a report. I think it was in the New York Times today. They were saying that the U.S. guidelines for healthy eating and what we're consuming, they said they continue to ignore health officials' recommendations about cutting out sugar and alcohol. I said, wow, plant-based eating, whole food diet, getting rid of those sugars. Now, hey, you can still have all the nuttiness. You know, I talked about making red velvet cake and all that. You can still do all that. But I mean, to have that in moderation and to make much more of your diet about fruits, vegetables, plants, get some raw ones in there, making that the gist of what you're eating on a regular basis, not a lot of processed foods, junk, dairy, cheese, all the rest, potato chips, and then alcohol. Like, none of that is what we need to be consuming. Mr. O.J. Simpson, sobriety being so, they even threw that in and said, oh man, Howard Stern was talking about it, said, oh man, O.J., he was hyped up on meth and went out and killed, did these murders, Butcher of Brentwood. Yeah, he was hyped up on all these drugs. Said, man, O.J. Simpson volunteered his blood the day after the murders. The prosecution easily could have submitted that as evidence that in addition he had meth and PCP and cocaine and heroin and all the rest in his system. He's a no-count, drugged-up nigra. That didn't come out during the trial, I don't believe. Even still, sobriety would be best with Mark Furman's and all the other problems that we have. Woo, all the chaos in D.C. right now. You do not want to be intoxicated and have to make life-saving decisions where you might be a little bit impaired. In addition, I would say stay in the house. I've been saying that for a long time. All you have to do, I think, is look at the news today. That is a good reason to stay in the house. If you have to go out, man, I would be super vigilant about what's happening around you. I definitely would not encourage any sort of like verbal altercations with anyone about anything, masks, the election, anything. If it looks like somebody is getting loud, hostile, hey, distance. I am not going to hang out here. Like I said, I'm not going to wrangle and argue with you or what have you. This is done. I'm going to be thinking this person could be armed. Psychopath, just like Mark Furman. This person might have 5-10 other white women, white men, whole motley collection, all armed, ready to deal with a nigra. I did not leave my house for Mortal Kombat. I'm getting out of here. That should be how we're thinking. Avoiding all of that. It's been way too dangerous. 2021 doesn't seem it. Obviously, 2021 seems no safer. So if we are going out, we're sober. We are super vigilant. If you are driving or passenger, you are buckled. If you're driving, you're not on the cell phone. As I said, we need to be very aware of what is happening around us. And we're trying, just doing the small things to minimize contact with the Amber Geigers, the Mark Furmans of the known universe. Sober, buckled, not on the cell phone, just the little things that we can do to minimize contact. All of that said, Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cow signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim,
your
brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning.
Mm-hmm.
Even my conditioning has been conditioned.